Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Mentally ill adults who kill are one in a million. And because of that, they garner most of the headlines, all of the attention, but always after the tragic fact. We saw it at Virginia Tech, in Tucson, Arizona, and most recently in Aurora, Colorado. The number of mentally ill adults who struggle without diagnosis or adequate treatment, who live without proper homes, who subsist on the fringes of our society, number in the millions. And just because they are out of sight or out of mind doesn't mean they don't affect the rest of us. Mental illness is one of the leading causes of disability in the United States, where roughly 10.4 million adults live with serious mental illness. Joining us now to talk about the incidence of adults with serious mental illness and adult onset mental illness is Terry Russell. He's the executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Ohio. Welcome to the show, Terry.
Thank you, Ann. I like being here.
So once again, when a tragedy like Aurora, Colorado strikes, when a shooting like that occurs, you probably get an uptick in the interest in serious mental illness, no?
Absolutely. And unfortunately, this is a mean illness. And the stigma associated with the illness, because our symptoms are so pervasive right out in front of everybody. And then when these horrible things happen, our society, for whatever reason, interprets that everybody with these illnesses are like this. And the fact is, there's not right facts. The fact is that a person with a biological brain disorder or mental illness are six times more likely to be a victim of crime than committing a crime. People don't see that. But, you know, many times you'll see a bank robber and the bank robber was mentally ill. I don't think I've ever heard news about a bank robber having cancer or having a heart condition. But if it's mental illness, for whatever reason, our society has decided that we're going to put that right out in front of everybody.
And yet we don't give it the same sort of credence when it comes to treating it, funding treatments for it, funding research on it, and that sort of thing.
Absolutely. The biggest problem here is it's grossly underfunded in treatment. And the other thing that's sad about that is our success rate for recovery is greater than most other illnesses. A person with a bipolar illness, if they're receiving their treatment, taking their medications, they do very well. 80% success rates. No other illness can say that. But for whatever reason, we look at this illness as so mystifying that there's not a political will to put the resources where they need to be.
There seemed to be a political will a few years ago when George W. Bush was in office. He did have an initiative in that direction.
Unfortunately, that was the President's Commission on Mental Illness, and the best report I've ever read in my 40 years in this business, but it was never implemented. And that happens time and time again. We know what it takes to help people get through these mental health issues and become productive citizens. First of all, you can't just go and get therapy or take medication and think that you're going to be okay. All of us need those community support services, such as a place to live, good meals every day, and a friend. So many of the people I work with and become a mission in my life are those who are so sick that they've lost everything. They get up in the morning and nobody knows their name. It's just so tragic. And it doesn't have to happen. That's what's bad about this. It doesn't have to happen. If we do early intervention, get involved early, people function very well.
We wanted to talk about adult onset mental illness because that seems to be most common, might be the wrong word, but only addressed at large when there's a tragedy. And, you know, somebody like the guy who's accused in the Aurora, Colorado shootings, the first thing that comes out is people ask immediately, is he mentally ill? And then the indications start to come out that, yeah, he maybe is, perhaps he's seen mental health professionals and that sort of thing. But you don't ever get a sense from people who are around them very much when they're interviewed that they knew anything was happening. It's sort of like the proverbial guy next door who said, oh, he always seemed like a nice guy. You said that the symptoms earlier on, you said the symptoms of mental illness are so out in front of everybody. But on the other side of that coin is they can also be extremely hidden.
I think they're hidden sometimes because people don't want to recognize them as much as they aren't hidden. When someone is hallucinating or has some kind of withdrawal from everyone. They're always feeling sad, confused. Their eating habits change. We see it, but we don't recognize that that's a problem. And we've got to do that. Unfortunately, with these horrendous crimes, most of them have been in care. We do know that they had a problem. But then there's also laws around that that keep that population protected in some cases, that the right people, we can't force people into the right kind of treatment that they need, so those things don't happen. There's a bill currently in the state legislature, Senate Bill 350, that we're supporting, trying to have outpatient, quartered outpatient commitment, where we recognize that the person may at a particular time not be a danger to some, danger to others, but their symptoms are so pervasive, they're there, that we see them, that we know that if nothing happens, they will end up in a hospital or in a jail or somewhere. So we're trying to get that passed this year.
My guest is Terry Russell. He's executive director of NAMI Ohio. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about adult onset mental illness, serious mental illness, the kinds that, you know, maybe you don't necessarily see, but affects all of us, disables millions every year. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. If you want to talk about that, if you have a story about adult onset illness in your family, maybe you've experienced it yourself and want to tell us your story. The idea of adult onset, I wanted to talk about that a little bit, because when you look at the statistics, if you're really strict about how you define adult, then it's not as bad. But when you broaden that out and think about when the symptoms first started to show up on different kinds of severe mental illnesses, it can start, you know, I guess I'm thinking more in the 14, 15, the young adult range, when they start to pop up. What do we know about why some of those illnesses don't make themselves, you know, the symptoms don't start occurring until you're older?
Yeah, the Mayo Clinic did a thorough study of age when people started exhibiting these illnesses. And we find that 50% of all the illnesses were exhibited with people about 14 years old. By the year they're 22, 75% have developed some kind of mental illness. And we also have to remember that one in four individuals in our society will have a mental illness of some type during a given year. I mean, this is a major, major illness. It's not just something that happens to others. It happens to all of us. And the families and are affected. The friends are affected. Everybody's affected. People at work. So what we've recognized is early onset, and that's why we really spend a lot of time in college years, schizophrenia in particular, mean illness, and start exhibiting the kind of hallucinations and behaviors at about 18 to 22. We see that as the age limit or period. Mm-hmm. Now, there's variables there.
Sure. But the problem is a lot of people that age are either away at college or moving out of the house, becoming independent in a really what would ordinarily be a very healthy way. Parents aren't as in close touch with their children as they were when they were 10 and 11 years old.
There are a lot of risks involved in this. It's somewhat funny that we find out that you know, the whole parenting issues surrounding if a parent has had a mental illness, there is a higher chance of the sibling having or the child having an illness. If there was trouble during the pregnancy, we have statistics that show that there's a higher percentage. Life stresses, financial problems, divorce, going to college, leaving the home. All of those things are part of, and we don't have the science to know exactly, but we do know that all of those stress factors have an impact on those who become ill and become really disabled by this illness for whatever period of time.
I know you've been spending a lot of time over the last several years staunching the flow of funds, particularly state funds, away from mental health, mental illness treatment. And I know it wasn't as bad as you thought it would be the last round, but what in general about healthcare reform? What about healthcare reform maybe has helped or not? Did it address these issues?
Well, we're not sure yet because it really hasn't been implemented. We do support the whole concept of healthcare reform because it's going to make more people eligible for care that are not currently getting care because they can't afford it. Hopefully, that'll also provide a treatment system that is available for people when they need it. I received a call the other day, matter of fact, here in Franklin County, person needed care, and it was going to be 6 months before they could see a psychiatrist. Well, that means they're not going to see a psychiatrist, and we need to make resources available so that person can be seen immediately. I'll tell you what will happen with that particular person. She'll go to the emergency room 5 or 6 or 8, 10 times. 1 out of every 7 people that go into emergency room go in because of a mental health issue, which emergency room is not equipped to deal with that issue and becomes a very expensive way.
If there is the coverage that you're hoping for, would there be enough psychiatrists to treat the people out there?
We're seeing that we think that there would be if we would make it attractive for physicians to go into this field. Any physician listening to the show should know this is a very honorable and tremendously rewarding field to be in because you do see outcomes. You do see that you've saved people's lives. When we look at suicide in this state or in this country, it's an epidemic. And if you know that you can stop some of those things from happening, it's one tremendous vocation.
What about insurance now? Are insurance carriers increasingly covering it as it stands or decreasingly covering mental health coverage?
Well, a few years back, we did get parity in the legislation where insurance companies had to treat mental illness just like any other illness. But like anything else, there's always the bureaucracy and the way of getting around doing that. And we're finding that it's more and more difficult for all people with insurance to get the kind of coverage they need. They're getting coverage, but there's usually a high copay or there's limits on your stay. For example, I think if you go to a psychiatric unit in a private hospital, your stay may be limited to 5 days. We're trying to change that to where because if you limit it and the person's still has the problem, you've wasted the 5 days. So we really believe that it should be on client care and not on financial availability of funds.
So what about the bottom line? I mean, we know what does the untreated mental illness cost our nation now? Do we know?
Oh, we know it's the leading cause of people not going to work and losing productivity. And I don't know that we know the exact numbers, but it's just gigantic when you look at alternatives that we could save this money. You know, we put a person in a state hospital today. It's almost $550 a day. What if we could find an alternative to that? And we do. We have alternatives to that, where the person could be somewhere for a longer period of time, but for $100 a day. It just doesn't make sense. The problem that we have right now in this system, and it's not anybody's fault. I don't want – everybody tries to do well. We have amazing people working in the mental health system. But change is hard. And what we need to do is take the money we have now and look at what we've done for 50 years, and we haven't changed much. We still have a community mental health center where people go in, get their counseling, get their medications, and leave. We need to be looking at a comprehensive system of care that provides a umbrella where people live. Again, our theme during our budget this last year was you can't get better if you don't have a roof over your head, food in your belly, and someone knows your name. So if you go in and get all the medication in the world, see a psychiatrist every day and walk out the door and you don't have a place to live, you're not going to get better. So what we're looking for is a comprehensive changing system using the resources we have. Emergency rooms, I just said 1 in 7 people going in an emergency room. What if we could shift the resources that are being the insurance companies and governments paying for that over into some alternative into real treatment? And not only that, we'd really help a lot of people.
We're talking about adult onset mental illness today. If you have a question or comment, my guest is Terry Russell, Executive Director of NAMI Ohio. And coming up, we're going to talk to the Director of Counseling and Consultation Services for the Office of Student Life at Ohio State University. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point History, Blue Ocean and China, we'll look at the high seas showdown between China and its neighbors over the South China Sea and more. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point is this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today. 71 degrees with sunshine and warming up to a high of 87 today. Clear skies for tonight, a low of 59 degrees. More sunshine and warmer on Friday with a high of 88. Clear skies Friday night, a low of 62. Support for 89.7 comes from Palmer Miller Nelson Insurance Agency, Incorporated. Serving Central Ohio homeowners and businesses since 1855. More information at 261-6300 or online at pmnins.com. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Intellect and potential have no sway with serious mental illness, and often, by the time it strikes or is noticed, the victim is a young adult, away from home for the first time, and can easily fall between the cracks. Joining us now to talk about how OSU works to flag and treat students is Mickey Sharma. He's Director of the Counseling and Consultation Service for the Office of Student Life at OSU. Welcome to the show, Mickey.
Thank you, Ann. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning, now.
Yes, also with us still is Terry Russell, Executive Director of NAMI Ohio. So, Mickey Sharma, every time there's a student-related killing on or off campus, your blood pressure must go up just a little bit, right?
Just a little bit. But I can tell you that, I wish I could say that we wouldn't have any more of these future tragic events that impact our campus community here at Ohio State. But unfortunately, when you've got a total of, 60 some thousand students across all of our campuses, we are going to have tragedies that happen. It's a part of the work that we're in. I would say that I think we do a phenomenal job through student life overall at really kind of coordinating the response that we make in these critical incidences to provide services both for the victims directly and their support families, as well as the other members of our community who are impacted directly and indirectly when we have a tragedy or a student death, such as the example you just mentioned.
Well, let's break that down a little bit. But first, to our listeners, if you know somebody or if you were somebody who became mentally ill while you were in college, if you want to call us and tell us what the process was for you and how you managed, to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Mickey Sharma, let's just, like I said, break it down. A student, first of all, how are staff, RAs, that sort of thing, educated about what to look for?
We do a lot of training, both directly from folks at Counseling Consultation Service who provide training across campus, as well as other members from the student life community. And we definitely provide comprehensive training for our residence hall staff. The residence hall staff goes through a comprehensive multi-week training program. Included in that are things to look for and how best to assist and recognize signs of students who are in distress. Okay. We provide similar trainings for faculty and staff across campus at multiple times during the year. So our goal in this is to make everybody in the Ohio State community not a therapist, but rather someone who has some basic tools and skills in looking at what are signs to look for and what are ways to engage a person in a conversation when you have some concerns about them. And then the next part of that is how do you get them over to our office so we can start to work with them, provide some mental health treatment, and work them towards the road to recovery.
A study by the American College Counseling Association found that 37.4% of college students who seek help have severe psychological problems. That's up from 16% in 2000, and that's quite a leap. And I was wondering a couple things, whether or not you've seen that sort of increase at Ohio State, and number two, whether you understand where that increase is coming from. Is it just because the reporting's better? Is it because the students are better educated about mental illness and seek help sooner or more frequently?
Well, here's what I'd say. You know, this is my second year at Ohio State, and the data you're reporting there, I think what we're finding locally at Ohio State as well as nationally is there is an increase in students who are coming to college and who are at college today who have mental health symptoms or mental health issues. So I think there's a number of reasons for that. And I think that means as an institution, we need to be better prepared because these are our students to provide them the support services so they can be academically successful, they can graduate and move on to their careers. I think that it means a number of things. I think that one of the things it means is that while there still is a stigma regarding mental health issues, that stigma has been reduced. It's not as strong as it was, say, in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. I'd also think it means that college has become more of an option for individuals who have emotional problems than, again, it was 25, 30 years ago. These are good things. It means that higher education is becoming an option for more members of our state, of the nation, of the community. And so people who would not have considered college as an option years ago may now be considering that and are coming to campus.
So that's kind of good news in a way.
I think it's good news. Yes. And I think you spent time with me, you're going to find I'm a glasses that full
right,
kind of person.
Right.
But I think that, you know, if we can get more people in the higher education communities, we get more people to Ohio State, I think this is a good thing. And we get them here and we provide the supportive services to help them be successful in their academic careers and into their lives.
Terry Russell?
I think we should learn from, because Ohio State does just a tremendous job, but we should learn that they have a closed environment and they provide a system of care for all of their students. And if we did that for people outside mm-hmm. of a university and had those same kinds of supports, we could have the same, achieve the same goals.
Right, because Terry was talking about 1 out of 7 people who go to an emergency room are going there for a mental health problem. So I wondered if that statistic is echoed at the health center at OSU and what you do when that does happen.
What we do and what happens.
When a student does show up, and they're showing up at the equivalent of the emergency room, and they don't necessarily know exactly why they're not feeling right.
Well, we work collaboratively both with the Student Health Services, which is a part of student life on campus, mm-hmm. as well as with the Ohio State, you know, through the Wexner Medical Center, through the emergency department, and the Harding Hospital that's on campus. So we are fortunate that if we have a student who needs a higher level of care, needs to be evaluated for an inpatient admission, we can get them to the hospital to be evaluated and admitted over to Harding. So we're fortunate in that way that, you know, these are places that are literally within walking distance, but folks can get be transported over there. So what we do, we're an outpatient counseling center. So we treat people here who are able to work through outpatient counseling services. However, we definitely have many students who get to a point where that's not going to be sufficient care, and they need to go into an inpatient stay for a while. And that happens. And when that happens, we will then coordinate care upon their release to help reintegrate them back into the university community, continuation of mental health treatment. And we also have a Department of Student Advocacy that can work with students who may need to maybe take an academic term off and return home for a bit of time and just get a little more stabilized before they're ready to, you know, really fully reengage as a university student.
And help them do that in a way that doesn't make them feel like they've failed, that
right.
they can do
right.
It's a manageable type of break.
That's right, Ann. And so what we'll talk with students about is your overall goal here is to graduate. We can still help you make that happen. You're just going to take a different path to get there.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about adult onset mental illness. My guest, I'm talking with Mickey Sharma. He's director of the Counseling and Consultation Service for the Office of Student Life at The Ohio State University. And also, Terry Russell is with us. He's executive director of NAMI Ohio. If you have a question or comment for them, we want to talk about it. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What are the rules, Mickey Sharma, about contacting parents and or, you know, anybody, family members in general?
Well, in our office, Once we engage a student in treatment, then confidentiality applies. So there certainly are occasions in which we will involve families in treatment, but we can only contact a family from our office when the student has given us permission to do so, and that will happen commonly. We will also have occasions where a parent may contact us about concerns about their son or daughter. Now, if they've not given us permission to disclose information to their parents, I can't provide that information. However, I certainly can listen with them, I can take information from mom and dad, and I can talk with them about the services that we provide and how we assist all students in that way. But we're not permitted by law to just contact parents against a student's wishes in that way.
Going back to when the university decides to keep a student in classes, keep them in school, or maybe have them take off a semester. Now it is a semester. How is that determined? What's the tipping point? I know every situation is different, but in general, what are you looking for? Does the issue of whether the student is ever a danger to others or him or herself, is that part of the equation?
Yeah, that's certainly, the danger to self or others can be a part of the equation. The first thing there is our first concern, if that's the case, is what do we need to do to make sure that the person is no longer at threat of harm to self or other, regardless of whether they're going to be a student or not. We'll look at that. But in terms of if someone needs to take an academic term off, what we're going to look at there is where the student is at that point in time. Are they going to be able to be academically successful? Or has the mental health condition come to a point where it's going to significantly impact their ability to fulfill their academic obligations? And if someone's at that point, they can't concentrate, they can't think academically, then we'll start to have that dialogue with them about maybe what you need to do is take an academic term off or leave this term and return in the next term. Oftentimes what you'll see is people will have significant sleep disruption. If people aren't sleeping well, then you can't concentrate. When you can't concentrate, now your academics are impacted. And what we don't want to see happen is someone continue in classes and not do well, which is going to have a further negative impact on their academic career. So we'll look at them about what is the best choice to make at this point in time.
The man accused of killing the people in the movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, apparently or allegedly saw mental health professionals at the University of Colorado. I'm wondering, I know you can't comment on that specific case, but if there is a case where you're worried about them going forward, even though you're releasing them and they're not necessarily your liability, after all of these cases that have emerged now, you have to ask yourself, what would I do? What would you do if there was somebody you're concerned about that's not your problem anymore?
Well, what we would do, if we have any concerns about an individual who we're concerned about acting out in a violent way, and we think this person has planned and intent to harm others, we will take all the steps that we can take, precautions to ensure that that doesn't happen. That can involve coordination with law enforcement, and that could involve coordination with law enforcement, both university law enforcement and potentially off-campus, mm-hmm. municipal law enforcement as well. The bottom line is, if we have concern, I mentioned confidentiality and parents earlier, but if we have concern that someone is going to take action to harm others, we will take all steps that are possible to ensure that that doesn't happen.
I think it should be pointed out, however, that is such a remote number of people. I don't want people listening here today to
it's
think,
a remote number of people, which right. It's kind of exactly so the chances of doing it and
right.
finding that and knowing
right.
when the right time to do that
and
is
I think
remote
the answer
well.
Mickey's answer is absolutely correct, but again, for the listeners, that just is not a common or even in the equation of behavior of most people who have a mental illness.
And it, if I would, to expand upon the point Terry just made, let me also highlight that folks who have a significant mental illness are more likely to be a victim of a crime than they are to be a perpetrator of a crime. And that oftentimes is not the message that gets out there. But these are folks who are more likely to be victimized than they are to be perpetrators of violence.
Jerry in Galway, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. You were a student who came down with a mental illness.
Yes.
What? Tell us your story.
All right. I had been dealing with depression for a long time, and then in my 20s, I went to the University of Miami in Ohio. And at that time, I was pretty near my breaking point. And what I remember most is the isolation and the reaction and response from most students. It was mingled with fear and scorn. Mm-hmm. And I was abused. And it wound up that I felt like I had to carry a knife in order to protect myself. Well, things did come to a head, and I did wind up at my own initiative at the University of Miami clinic there. Mm-hmm. At the time, I was carrying the knife because I did it the first time. You know, I couldn't tell you at the time that I was mentally ill. All I knew was that I was alone. And I was duly interviewed, but it was the lousy type of interview, because now I was a social worker for a year, mm-hmm. for a couple of years, and I worked in a clinical department there. And one guy said, "Oh, he's really weird." Of course, that ended the interview. Mm. And thank God I finally had the breakdown at my brother's, and I was able then to get the help I needed.
Mickey Sharma, I guess the isolation is an interesting topic, and Jerry, please, thank you for your call. We really appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
The isolation, that must come up a lot.
And that's right. I think that is an a significant piece, especially in a campus community. We try to, you know, educate members of our community, whether it's faculty, staff, especially our residence hall staff, to pay attention for individuals who have become isolated. And that can happen to our commuter students as well. Mm-hmm. And so that's who we want to try to reach and reach out to and get them connected into supportive services, because we do know, and I think Terry previously was talking about suicide and folks with mental illness, and the research is clear in the university setting that once we get folks into treatment at the University Counseling Center, the risk of dying by suicide goes down exponentially.
An email from Pam. She says, while working at OSU in student health, I found it very difficult to have patients seen the same day as I referred them. Also, I found it very difficult to get any information from CNC after I had referred them. What can be done to facilitate the conversation between the primary care doctor and the behavioral health specialist? And before we move on to that question, Mickey, can you tell us what CNC is?
I'm guessing that the person is referring to Counseling Consultation
okay.
Service, which would be
okay.
CCS, which is our department.
All right.
So to facilitate care, we have regular meetings set up between our Associate Director for Clinical Services, that's Dr. Ronnie, and Dr. Kias, the Clinical Director over the Student Health Service. We will coordinate with them with referrals back and forth, and we will have releases of information signed at our department and at the Student Health Service to facilitate that piece. In terms of getting students seen on an ongoing basis and on an immediate basis, at our department, we will have both regular ongoing initial appointments for students, as well on a daily basis, we have reserved what we call more urgent appointments. So if someone is in some situation where they need to be seen immediately, then we have availability to see them same day.
Well, Mickey Sharma, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
All right. Take care. Thanks for having me.
Mickey Sharma, he's Director of the Counseling and Consultation Service for the Office of Student Life at The Ohio State University. When we return, we're going to hear from a family who is working to make some changes for adults who live with mental illness. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Walk into a tea shop in Kabul, and Dexter Filkins told Charlie Rose, you'll hear talk of fear. What happens when the Americans leave?
The fix is the Afghan army. I mean, that's it. We're rolling the dice.
I'm Neil Conan, Afghanistan After America. Dexter Filkins is among our guests. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes. Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and The Art of Comforting in Times of Stress with author and grief counselor Val Walker. Join us for that discussion from 11 till noon here on 89.7 NPR News. And you can learn more about All Sides with Ann Fisher, all of the guests and topics, by liking our show on Facebook. Also, be sure to follow WOSU All Sides on Twitter. And you can discover even more by visiting our website, WOSU.org/allsides. 71 degrees with sunshine and a high of 87 for today. Clear skies for tonight, a low of 59 degrees. Sunshine and a high of 88 on Friday. Clear skies Friday night, a low of 62. And more sunshine and a high back up near 90 for Saturday. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking about adult onset mental illness today. Still with us, Terry Russell, Executive Director of NAMI Ohio, joining us now. Elaine Goldberg, she's founder of Melissa's House. Elaine, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And also Billy Goldberg, he's a board member of Melissa's House. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
After Melissa Goldberg, a Columbus School for Girls graduate with every bright prospect, was diagnosed with schizoid affective disorder in the mid-1990s, your family worked tirelessly to help her get treatment and also find the semblance of a decent life, a good home and friends and an occupation. Terry Russell has brought up that issue of somebody who knows their name, mm-hmm. you know, when they're wherever they're living. Billy, you're just 11 months apart from your sister, and you were very close in age as well as in life. What first alerted you as her brother and one of her closest friends to that something might be wrong with Melissa?
Probably the inability to maintain relationships that she had for her whole life. Just things just started to deteriorate in terms of her ability to communicate with people and sort of stay connected to them.
What about you, Elaine? Was it the same sort of thing? Was she away at college by then?
Yes. She really started her beginning of her sophomore year. Her roommates called and said she was acting a little strange, so we brought her back here. Not totally noticeable because she always acted just a tad strange. She always did have relationship issues. She was fine to go anywhere and do anything as long as somebody called her and asked her to do it, but she wouldn't reach out to make the plans. And I think a lot of that was her insecurity that what if they said no? So it was better to be asked. And I don't think she ever realized how many friends she actually did have. And it is shocking to see the people that came back from her funeral, from her class, all over the country, and continue to stay involved and want to know about her. And she never had that sense that she had friends or good friends.
Melissa died of a brain aneurysm at the age of 36. But you didn't stop after that. You kept going because there's others, many others out there like her. You formed a nonprofit organization to provide permanent housing for adults who are battling mental illness. When did it occur to you that you had resources, she could get treatment, she had people who loved her and cared about her and were trying to take care of her, but when did it occur to you that that wasn't enough, that there needed to be outside resources as well, and they weren't there?
I think when we started to look for places for her to be, and there weren't any, and we went to New England where there seemed to be more and spent a lot of time in New England in and out of different places that never quite met our expectations and were very, very expensive. So we decided to bring her back here, have her live with us and see if she did any better. and she was most comfortable at Ohio State University in the hospital.
I think that some people lose sight of the fact that we're all products of our environment, and if you're not well enough to really function in society, it doesn't mean that you need to be in a place that isn't acceptable to live and to function. And if you're in a warm environment and if you're in a place that encourages well-being, it's a lot easier to be well, I think. And those sorts of places didn't really exist out there.
And Tara, you mentioned just having someone know your name and someone who knows you.
Absolutely. First of all, I have so much admiration for this family who, after this, has gone so far in helping the people that I've given my whole career and my life to. We have so many people out there that do great things and should be, and sometimes hit brick walls in trying to do it, which is even worse. But we have so many people who, after so many years with this illness, have lost everything. They don't have the families that have stayed with them, and they're out there. I had a picnic for 500 or for 100 clients up in Cleveland a few years ago, and this man was going to lose his home. They were going to close his home, and he'd been there 20 years, and it wasn't a very nice home. And I was worried about him because I didn't think anybody in the morning would know who he was. And all at once, another client, a large African-American gal with dirty T-shirt and sweatpants, tapped him on the head and took his hair out of his eyes. And I thought, at least she knows his name. At least she cared about him. And that's what we have to do with so many of these people is have the compassion. And sometimes that's why NAMI, the National Alliance for Mental Illness, is such special to me, is because it's families and consumers out there themselves know what they need.
And to add to that point, that's what we at Melissa's House will be doing, is offering support for people and a family atmosphere for them and hope for them to regain their family. And as so many of them are estranged from their loved ones, we hope to bring it back. We will be having community dining because this population tends to isolate. And we want to bring them together for meals for several reasons. One, so that they do have the camaraderie. The second one is so that they can learn food preparation, so that someday when they can live on their own, they'll know how to do things. But the most important part of that is also when consumers live with each other, they can see when there might be a spiraling down and when there might somebody might need help that doesn't realize they need help. So there's a lot of reasons to bring them together.
Betty in Canal Winchester, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Betty.
Thank you very much. I'm just really pleased with the program this morning. I'm the mother of a 34-year-old son who is, I consider, a success story. He's just won an award, a grant award from the Ohio Arts Council for his photography. But he dropped out of Ohio State in 1999. The services then were not quite what they are now, and I'm pleased to hear about the improvement. Returned to the community where he grew up, which is Athens, which turned out to be very fortunate. And one of the things I was living in another state, but fortunately the other state had the family-to-family program, which NAMI sponsors, and I just, again, can't say enough good things about that, because it made it possible for me, as I was listening to him on, with long-distance phone conversations at that time, to realize that he was really more than just a little bit depressed, that he was getting to the point where he could have become very violent. And so I was able to warn his father, who was in Athens at the time. And the other thing that I want to say good things about is the CIT program, which is training for law enforcement people so that they have an awareness of mental illness and how to handle someone, a mentally ill person who is potentially violent. And my son was taken to the psychiatric hospital in handcuffs, but he received, it's taken a long time to get the right medications, but he is now a real asset to everyone who knows him. And so there are some formal programs in place, like family-to-family and CIT training for law enforcement. But the other aspect, and I think your previous callers have mentioned this as well, is the informal involvement of other people in the community. friends of the family were able to give my son some part-time employment doing yard work and that sort of thing. That was helpful. The other, of course, really significant program for him in Athens has been the Athens Photographic Project. Terry Russell is very familiar with that. And that just unleashed Paul's tremendous creativity. What we wish, though, is that there were programs like that in every community and also in all aspects of the arts. Paul has a very good friend who's very interested in music, and there just isn't the same outlet for him that Paul has with his photography. So I really want to encourage all of your listeners to be aware of people, again, to provide, we need to provide that community which does not only provide folks with friendship and so they don't feel so isolated, but also to be aware of ways in which we might be able to see the person, not just the illness, and to discover what untapped abilities we might be able to encourage that person and maybe even assist them in finding ways to develop their abilities and their creativity. So anyway, I'm just, I'm really, every time there's a tragedy, I just am so grateful for all of the things that have gone right for my son, because I could have been a parent of someone like the unfortunate parents of those who, you know, have committed tragedies in our country. But in on the But now I'm not. I'm just writing high as a parent of a young man who has discovered that he has a tremendous creative abilities and can really be a gift to the community in which he lives. And I think that should be our goal for all folks who have a serious psychiatric disorder.
All right, Betty, thank you so much for your call. Take care. An email from John, too. He says, I have a young family member, 21 years old, who recently developed schizophrenia. It took an enormous effort to get him help. He was treated by NetCare for a week and released on medication. 5 days later, he wandered into someone's apartment, charged with burglary, and now sits in jail awaiting felony sentencing. We are beyond frustrated. He's not a criminal. Why can't we keep these people out of the penal system? Yeah. Elaine Goldberg.
I think part of what we're doing from Melissa's House is our institute, and what we want to do there is to educate and advocate for mental illness. So many people do not recognize mental illness. The stigma is so huge that they don't want to get help. They don't want the label. And it's just an illness, just like any other illness. It's like having diabetes. It's like having a heart condition. And it needs to be accepted for those reasons and understood. So part of our goal with the Institute is to educate all walks of life, the employer, the employee, the general public about mental illness, because you are not treating a mental illness when somebody's in jail.
And I think it's so important for your listeners to understand that that story can be multiplied by thousands. At NAMI, Ohio, we receive hundreds of calls with the same outcome.
A very large percentage of people who are incarcerated have some.
It's about 22% of those in the state prisons and about 28% in our jails. And many of those could have been diverted if services were available. The father saying what he just said and the pain of his son living in a prison, by the way, or a jail, $75 a day, where for less than that, we could have that person living in a treatment environment dealing with his issues. That's what needs to be the scream out there for change, to make sure that services are available for that son. It breaks our hearts.
And I think just to go back to the caller prior to the email, if more people paid attention to the patient's strengths rather than their weaknesses, we would probably avoid some of this as well. She was able to find some things that he did really well, the photography and other art outlets. If that was available, and those are the kinds of things that we're trying to do with Melissa's House, is okay, so you have this illness, and as my mother alluded to, it's just like having any other illness. So you've got this thing, but really what can you do? You want to paint? Let's figure out a way to
get you to paint. The same way we think of people, anyone with a disability.
Exactly. You know, so play to your strengths. Mm-hmm.
I think it's so important for the listeners and also to understand this. The photography project that was talked about, we gave Athens 12 years ago $8,000 to start that program. 8 years or 12 years ago, $8,000. They have graduated hundreds through that project, and we have a mother now saying it changed her. It's not all about money. It's about having programs that work, that change a person's whole identity. And we're very proud of that program.
I want to talk a little bit more about Melissa's House before we run out of time, because it's not just an idea. It's an actual place. It's located on the east side. It's not occupied yet, right?
Right.
There is a fundraiser coming up on September 7th, I think, for that. And if anybody wants to learn more about that, they can go to melissashouse.org, and we'll have that link on our website as well, too. But tell us, Elaine, before we run out of time, about Melissa's House and what you're talking about here.
Okay. We have a facility at 100 Jefferson Avenue, which is just one block west of 71. It is in the, we like to call it the cultural corridor, the Discovery District. It's around the library, the art museum, CCAD, and Columbus State. And we feel that we can pull on the strong points of our residents having to take advantage of these places. They are all very excited to work with us. CCAD said a huge,
speaking of art,
mm-hmm. a huge percentage of their students have mental disorders. And they have three full-time counselors there. So having Melissa's House people be there and either volunteer or be students would be nothing new or shocking for them. Columbus State has a program that teaches mental health workers. So we're very excited to be in our location. We are going to have the first phase will start, we hope, to renovate in spring.
Spring 2013, right?
Yes, so that we can educate on mental illness.
Well, I'm sorry we couldn't talk about it more, but maybe we'll talk about it again.
Love to.
Once again, there is a fundraiser for Melissa's House. Go to melissashouse.org to learn more about that. Terry Russell of NAMI, Ohio, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ann.
Also, Elaine Goldberg, founder of Melissa's House. Elaine, thanks for being here again.
Thank you.
And Billy Goldberg, board member of Melissa's House. Thanks again, Billy, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.